Hey there, Shop Maniacs. You're listening to another episode of the Shop Talk Show, a podcast all about front end web design and development. I'm Dave Rubin. With me is Chris Coyer. Hey, Chris, how are you
doing? That's going to be my new hobby, is to drop some news to you during the countdown of when the show starts.
You're like, as it's counting down, you're like, famous celebrity died. It's like, what?
What?
What? So anyway, hey.
I guess we don't know when this airs, so it could be old news or something. So it's not really.
Yeah, just anyway.
With just a normal episode here, I do have a list of people to invite. I know nobody cares, but they'll be great guests, you know? I like it when we pick, because it just feels, not that there's some like third party forcing us to pick, but when we're, it's not some news event necessarily, it's just us being like, hey, that looks interesting. That's what I want to do.
Yeah. Yeah, I, you know, we've been on the press tour before, and that's okay. It's fine. It's nice to talk about tech when it's happening, you know, but I think, you know, it's no secret. We tend to just talk to people we like and who are posting interesting things and doing interesting work. And
yeah, there you go.
There's really no mystery, right?
You know, it would, I think analytics in this case would influence my decision making there just out of vanity. But I have to report regularly the number of downloads for this show when we sell an ad, or basically when Buy Sell Ad sells an ad. They're always like, how many downloads did it get? And they're constantly tapping my shoulder to provide that number. The number is always the same.
Mm-hmm.
We get the same downloads no matter what we talk about, who we have on, when it's published, anything. Obviously, it varies between a couple hundred or so, but it's not like we're like, well, if we say React in the title, we get double the listeners. It's like, absolutely not. It really doesn't matter.
Doesn't impact it at all.
No.
That's why this episode's called React TypeScript Jobification.
So, yeah. Anybody that listens to this show is guaranteed a job.
Guaranteed a job listening to Shop Talk, the podcast. So
yeah.
Yeah, I think about career porn a lot. Do you know? Is this phrase okay to talk about on? Is it safe for work?
Think so. I don't know.
Just this, like, I see streamers and stuff, and you know, and I'm not throwing anyone under the bus or anything, but there's a lot of like, if you just keep working and apply yourself, and you're gonna get a job, man. And I'm like, maybe last year. Like, this year sucks, dude. You know, like, there's just all this, you know, there's been a interesting, you know, Michael Chan lost his job and has been very transparent about looking for work. I think that's pretty cool. You know, there's been like a kind of a, just, I don't know. I come across all this, like, just work hard and like, you'll get a job. And it's like, that's very cool advice for last year. Everything's different now, I feel like.
It makes me sad to even think about it. I mean, we certainly experience it in our Discord, people going on that journey. I'm in a recent new Slack with a bunch of authors talking about stuff, and they're like, I think of all of them as like famous, essentially, you know, like, mm-hmm. Look at you, top of your field, writing books, you know, and it's like, you know, I don't know what the percentage is, but there's plenty of people in there just being like, man, I'm looking,
yeah, you
know? And I'm like, yeah. You're looking? That sucks, you know? There's no guarantees in this dang old world.
No, that's just it is, you know, and I think it's just, you know. Yeah, I think the scale of this year has been hard, and tens of thousands of people have been laid off. And
yeah,
so the competition's real thick. You know, if somebody wants like a whatever left-handed person who speaks Portuguese and knows TypeScript, they can find that person. You know, they just have to wait around. And there's like almost, I've been thinking of it as like asymmetry, right? Like they can just, they have all the cards and power, and they can just wait around for the exact right person who meets their weird niche needs, you know? So,
yeah.
It's bizarre. So whereas like 2 years ago, somebody might've been like, dude, we got to get people coding. We got to get this thing done, you know? So, and now it's like, well, we're out of ideas. We're just waiting for AI to give us ideas. That's how it feels maybe. Like.
Anyway. It feels to me like it's going to come back, but I just can't promise that anymore. Because how would I know? I'm just some idiot, you know?
Well, it always has, you know? There's always been an upside to the downsides and stuff like that. But it just, I don't know. This one, I don't know. I don't mean to be like, I know, like, there's record numbers of jobs adding to the, you know, whatever, U.S. economy and all that stuff. I'm not, like, red-pilled or anything like that. But I just, the tech market is just really in a weird state. So, and I think that's because money froze up, you know, and everyone's buckling down. So I think it's a hard situation.
Probably, it got cool to do layoffs. And then usually the flip side of layoffs is like, oops, did too many. And then we just haven't seen that happen yet. And then AI is definitely throws a wrench in things too. People waiting around to be like, oh, maybe we know. Can this thing do people's jobs?
Well, I saw this thing, this like week or next week or something, my kids take STAR tests, like the Texas standardized test, right? Okay. Every couple of years and so. And there's like a, you know, multiple choice section of it, and then there's like a written portion of it. And I just saw in the Texas Tribune, kind of a independent news rag here in Texas. Oh, and I think, has Miranda worked with them? I feel like she has, maybe. Anyway.
The Texas Tribune?
Yeah.
Well, I definitely know people there because she was so involved in journalism and journalism organizations.
Yeah.
I don't know if she worked directly for the Tribune, but definitely we have like mutual friends through her work in that.
Overlappy there. Work. Yeah. Okay, yeah. Cool. So anyway, it's a pretty good independent news organization, really big on like data and kind of just providing accountability and stuff like that. Like they did this, sorry, I'll do the testing story, but like I'll come back to that. But one thing they did was they used AI. I saw this post where they used AI to basically find and calculate all these like uncapped wells, natural gas wells in Texas, like degrading or uncapped wells that are just spewing methane, right? And like they found out like there's like something, I don't even know, like millions of these wells just barfing methane into the atmosphere.
That's hard to think about. Like I understand what they're doing and that there was an outcome, but a lot of people think of, me included in this, think of AI now as a large language model. So you type in some stuff and it comes back. That can't look at methane output from geographical locations. So I don't understand. And or they think of like, oh, it can make an image.
Well, and it's probably machine learning is what it was. Like they taught a machine how to.
They gave it a ton of data.
Here's what a ugly uncapped. Here's a list of known things. Here's satellite photos. And here's what a broken well looks like. You know, so it's probably something like that. More machine learning style.
I see. So the model is their own. Anyway, go on. Yeah.
Oh, no. Well, so anyway, they do cool stuff with data. They're kind of like a, you know, when New York Times does cool data, they do that, but on the Texas level, right? But anyway, they had this article about like how they're going to grade the Texas Education Association or Agency, TEA, has decided to grade the STAR tests using AI, using ChatGPT.
Well, I can see that being pretty controversial.
Right.
It reminds me of the Weapons of Mass Destruction data or whatever that book is, where it was like, the problem with doing stuff like that is there needs to be a really clear model for fixing when it's wrong, because it's going to be wrong because we know AI is wrong all the time. So like, if you're going to say something like that, I want it to be in the next paragraph what you're going to do when it's wrong.
Well, and their thing is you can challenge the AI bot for $50. Mm-hmm. And if you win your case, you get the $50 back. But if you lose the case, you owe $50. I'm fine. Like, I'm sure we'll be there one day, but like ChatGPT came out like 2 years ago.
Like, just, and we're just shocked.
And we're just going to put millions of kids in the line of fire here. That seems so upside down. I'm not. Yeah. It's just wild to me what what the rapid decisions that are happening. I forgot how we got here. But anyway, I just like...
How did we get here?
How did we get here?
To talking about the Tribune?
Talking about O.J. Simpson, I think. And then, anyway, it's called... I just read a book called The Coming Wave by Mustafa Suleiman, who is the... currently the CEO of AI at Microsoft. He just got this new job created, the CEO of AI. And he used to be part of Google's DeepMind, you know, the Alpha Go bot that they made that beat the Go player and made everyone hate, not want to play Go anymore. This book is actually really good. I would recommend it. Like, I thought it was going to be kind of like, because I know like Microsoft's making big bets with AI and stuff like that. I thought this was going to be very right. Like,
so do they want him publishing a book that says like, I don't know about this AI stuff. You know, like, you know what, you know that it's going to be AI positive going into it, right?
Yeah, well, that's why I thought it was going to be very like cheerleader, you know, like very, very like, hey, this is awesome, dude, you know, but it's actually way more, the whole book is almost about this whole idea of containment. Like, we have this new tool that can do a lot of stuff, but we have, and it's going to, you know, based on his trending lines, you know, going to get more powerful and be more adopted by more businesses and things. And he actually wrote this before he was CEO of AI at Microsoft. But it's going to be more like more powerful, more used, more adopted in everyday life.
Doesn't that seem like, of course it is. I don't know. Like, why is that interesting?
Well, I think the argument is like, it's sort of like inevitable that this is going to overtake everything, you know? And so the whole book is kind of just about containment, this idea of like we need to make sure bad actors don't get this and use this in bad ways. You know, we need to make sure it's safe for humans. We need to make sure like the output is correct and good and stuff like that. So, and that it's not used for malicious purposes.
That's the Sam Altman model too, right? You just say that you're going to do that and then you just do whatever you want.
Sort of. Yeah. Yeah. But I think it's good. Like, you have ethicists or people who care about that in the AI sphere. I just thought it was going to be a total like, check out how awesome this is, you know, but it was way more level-headed than I thought. But yeah, it's, I don't know, I have millions of questions, but then like seeing like, you know, like the Texas education be like, we're going to use this tool. Like, I don't know. I sort of wish like Sam Altman would come out and be like, hey, don't, or like, maybe not, like, this is, I don't know, man.
Like, oh, like in a situation like that, could an AI leader who's got some actual clout see a use case for AI and say, please stop it? Because I've never seen it once. Not to say that it never has, because I'm just one guy. It's not like I read every AI news. In fact, I honestly like see AI news and I will tune out a little bit at this point. Because for some reason, it hasn't become that interesting to me. But I would read that article, or that would make like extra headlines outside of just AI circles, I think. To see something like that would be nice.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know.
I mean, I don't even know the details of the Texas thing, but just based on the few facts that you spit out, I'm like, absolutely not. Is it just because the other part is like, what were you doing before? Were you using human beings to grade the test?
That's where it was. Yeah, they were using human beings. And now they said, this is how I got to it. Yeah, that's too expensive. They're going to save $15 million by not, you know, which Texas, you know, libertarian taxpayers are like, yeah, that's awesome. But like, but you've now 4,000 graders don't have a job, like a seasonal job, you know, like for the test, you know, like they went from like 6,000 graders to 2,000 graders or something like that. And so
Now all they need is the person that collects the $50 to, they'll hand grade those.
Right? Yeah. They need a Stripe account. Yeah. To hand grade those. Right. And so like, who can afford the $50 to get a challenge?
Especially crazy, like, to me.
People with an extra $50. I just, oh man, I don't know. Oh, man. I just don't know anymore.
Well, here's a question from Max K about this job thing a little bit that maybe, you know, I can imagine us answering this question differently in different years and at different times.
Sure.
What he says is, I've been offered an interview for a position as a Drupal developer at a big university.
Take it.
We'd hardly need to keep reading. Done. Yeah.
All right. Yeah.
Show up with bells on, you know?
Yeah.
I've never used Drupal, but reading online, it seems, well, dead. I don't know about that. I don't think it's dead. I don't know that it's huge. I don't know how competitive it is anymore. You know, you used to kind of think about like what kind of market share do each of the big, you know, kind of PHP CMSs have. Mm-hmm. And they were, I don't feel like they were in second place at one point in my career anyway. And tech doesn't move that fast, you know, and the fact that you said big university tracks to me, I always thought Drupal for some reason had good inroads with universities and schools.
Universities, newspapers. Yeah.
I don't know what particular features it was, but sometimes it's not necessarily features. Sometimes it's just like culture and stuff that leads to that. So it's not surprising to me that has that. But yeah, you know, Max, straight up, you could replace Drupal with any other word, and Dave and I right now might just be like, yeah, go for it, man. You know, mm-hmm. They want to give you some money to do some work. Sounds great, you know? Hey, at least you're not a line cook at Applebee's like I was for many years, you know? And still think, there's still always a part in the back of my head that's like, I could do that if I had to. You know, I don't want to, but I'd rather be a Drupal developer at some university. But
hey, time out. Can you make a Bloomin' Onion? if I needed one right now, you could just whip it up for me?
I could, I think.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Anyway.
Okay. Yeah. I was more like the meat guy. You know, there's like three at the time. Yeah. There's three. There's the person in the middle who like was the, you know, they probably made 50 cents more an hour or something because they kind of brought all the dishes together, but also mm-hmm. had their own things they did. And then the meat guy was just on the grill constantly,
right,
making the fajitas and all that stuff. And then there's the fryer side too. It was like fryers
the fryer
and desserts.
Guy. Yeah.
And it all came together in the middle. And I never did multiple jobs. I was just meat only all the time.
I was the meat guy at McDonald's, which is not as complicated as Applebee's. It's just put patties on the thing. So
yeah.
And put the squisher on it. But that's interesting.
They still need the squisher person. You'd think if anybody was going to AI up some stuff, it'd be that. But it's not that I just did it. I said AI when I just mean a robot. There's nothing to do with AI, you know?
Yeah, it could be a mechanical robot, a mechanoid. So Drupal at a university, I mean, I would actually say like Drupal's sort of a neutral choice to me. I think like you're there, you're using Drupal. It's going to live for a long time because a lot of people are using it. And there's probably a lot of horizontal mobility working for different universities. If you know Drupal, a university is going to move a lot slower because it's, you know, than a startup, you know? So you just, that would be the big thing. Like, are you prepared for that phase, that like lifestyle where things are just kind of a lot slower? So that would be a question, the bigger question for me. If Drupal ends up stinking and not upgrading and not updating and not doing good for years or whatever, then guess what? You're part of the person who gets to move the needle inside a big university. You know, you get to say
possibly.
Like, let's
cool.
go to Drupal headless and move our whole, you know, stack to Svelte kit or something. And then maybe you are then the Drupal parts go become very background, or maybe you get them off of Drupal or something and you find the better thing. You know, I don't know what the better thing is, probably Craft CMS, but I think if it sounds okay to you, if it sounds like a good move, I would consider it. So
for sure.
My sentiment is like, just from following tech, is probably similar. It's like, it's not dead. It's just not like hustling and bustling. You know, they had a big, what is it? Drupal 8 big upgrade. I think they're on Drupal 9, if I'm wrong.
I think they're on 10 now, or at least 10 that's now? what they're, the website says. But you can tell that they're talking to, they're done talking to the public. Now they talk to existing Drupal users. It feels that way to me. So you're like, oh, Drupal 10. Let me see. Oh, wow, a big marketing page. What's included in Drupal 10? Let me tell you, Dave. The Claro administration theme replacing 7. The Olivero default theme replacing Bartik. You know, like, they're not talking to me, Chris Coyer. I have no idea what these words are.
Yeah, that means nothing to me. Yeah, that's...
yeah, right. So they're not interested in telling me why I should use Drupal. It doesn't seem like, anyway. I mean, that maybe that's unfair, but yeah. And the website just seems a little sloppy, you know? Like, maybe, I think that matters in this world. You know, you go to their website and you're like, you've been around for a long time and this is what you got design-wise? It's just that. It's not good.
Punch it up a bit. I agree. Punch it up a bit, but
like a library. I feel like the most tiny little new JavaScript library that does like one tiny little nothing these days has like a website that's three times as beautiful as this. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
I don't know. Maybe that's jerk league, but that's what I feel.
Yeah, like. I mean, like, Drupal runs like the MLS, like the Major League Soccer website. You know what I mean? Like, it's not dummies who are choosing Drupal. You know what I mean? It's like,
no,
big organizations are choosing Drupal for very specific reasons. So I don't know. I think it's still fine, unless it's not fine, unless somebody has a reason it's not fine. But, you know, I didn't know it was on Drupal 10. I think that's cool.
Yeah, they're Drupal go along just fine. Take the job, innovate, whatever.
Drupal probably just needs more people talking about Drupal, and that could be you. You know what I mean?
There you go. You've said that recently. That's become a little Dave catchphrase, hasn't it?
Yeah.
When organization or library or something does good work, sometimes they just don't talk about it enough.
Dude, yeah. That's probably my biggest takeaway from Luro, like starting my own company, is like, people don't know. And we, you know, at Paravel, we always had this saying, which is going to sound offensive, but like people don't give a shit, right? Like, everyone's too busy. Everyone's too in their own head, doing their own thing, fielding emails, taking meetings. Everyone's too busy to care. And so like, they're not going to like go to your website and read about it. You have to kind of just constantly be sharing the cool things about your thing. Your framework, your blog, your whatever. Mm-hmm. Like, you have to keep like advocating for the things you like. And that's even, you know, I say that to myself too. Like, you know, there's cool things about web components that like I want to tell people about and I just forget or just don't, you know? And so like, you know, if you like something, you should talk about it, and then other people will know about it, and then it'll get picked up, you know? So, yeah. So people just don't care, and people are too busy to care.
Yeah. Oh, fascinating. Well, you gear channeled me the other day. I'm pretty susceptible to it generally, but we have a gear channel in the Discord, and the joke is that we mentioned, I think, on here, that if you post something with any doubt that you, or you know, a question that you may or may not buy the thing, that you'll be pressured into it. But you know, you tend to pressure yourself too a little bit.
Yeah, you'll be peer pressured into buying whatever is in, you know, whatever. And so I posted. Do you want to say what I posted? You can go, because you actually bought it. I just asked the question. So.
I just think it's an amazing piece of technology in the world. But I can't even tell you who makes an SDFM. It's just some Chinese brand of something, yeah. Right? What, and you know, to not keep people in disbelief here, all it does is blow air. It's an air blower. It's just air shoots blower. Air out of it, right? But I had in my head some point, I don't know if this used to be true or never was true and my brain is just broken or something, but you know, they sell canned air.
Mm-hmm.
It's
mm-hmm.
just, you press the button down and it shoots air out of it. And it gives you that kind of like WD-40 long red hose thing that sticks out of the nozzle of it. I always kind of like that because you can stick that thing down in your keyboard. If you have a keyboard that isn't, you know, I know these days, a lot of people have low profile keyboards and stuff that probably doesn't help that much. But if you need to get some air down into a crevice, boy, nothing like canned air to do it. And then the can gets all cold and stuff. I just love it. I've had it very satisfying. But I am showered with guilt over it. I'm like, what kind of resources on planet Earth went into me getting this jar of air?
Yeah, yeah, I don't think it's actually good for the environment or anything.
Oh, I'm sure it's not. Yeah. And then you just throw it away because it's, yeah, you know, whatever. Yeah, yeah. So when you posted this, I'm like, oh, I've been wanting to get some canned air because I actually have some pretty practical uses for it. One, I have that kind of keyboard that you need to get the little crumbs out of and crap because I'm a filthy animal and eat at my desk at least a couple times a week. And worse, I have a desk where it's a glass top, but the top is, it's a piece of metal and then a piece of glass separated by little, you know, little gummy bears or whatever in the middle. And sometimes a little crumbs and crap get in between. Mm-hmm, I'm looking at tons of them right now. I really need to take the glass off of this desk and clean it and then put it back together. I like to do it like once a year, but it really needs it right now. But I'm like, but does it? Or can I shoot air in between the two things and solve this problem? The answer, unfortunately, is A, this device is amazing. The one you posted. And for some reason, it comes in Nickelodeon colors. It looks like a little gun that's orange, lime green, and deep purple, just like Nickelodeon.
Oh, I saw that. And that's what got me. That's what like almost nerd sniped me was like, can I pull off the Nickelodeon aesthetic, like the super soaker vibe, you know?
It looks great. They have one in black too, but I was like, why? It looks amazing in the Nickelodeon colors.
Yeah.
And so what it is a big battery pack. So it feels heavy in your hand, but the freaking motor on it just cooks.
It's really
just unbelievable how fast it spins a little fan. And it just feels like, yeah, of course they got, you know, there's nothing like breakthrough about it other than probably like these motors, this level of battery power and a motor like this probably just is relatively new to the world. Plus it was like $80 or something too. This isn't like a $10 thing, but no, I was like, I'll never buy canned air again. Now I have this thing, which charges via USB-C.
Ooh.
And now it'll shoot air forever. Now, it cannot shoot air out of the little WD-40 red hose thing. That's the downfall of this thing. So I can't actually get air in the perfect thing that I just described, getting the crumbs out between the glass and the desk. It does a little, but it can't really get in there like canned air can.
Fine tooth, yeah.
Which is a bummer, because that's the number one thing I wanted this for. But now that I have it, I also just think it's really fun to have a high power fan in my hand. So cool. I don't know. No regrets.
Yeah. No. Oh, man. I'm so tempted. And it, now that we've talked about it, everyone's going to buy them all. And then they're going to be. And now I'm.
Yeah.
I might have to pull the trigger before this goes out.
It's not on Temu either, man. It's just on regular old Amazon.
Yeah. Oh, man. I'm tempted. I'm super tempted. It would be great.
I'm basically an environmentalist at this point.
Yeah.
You know,
I wonder if you could 3D print like a tighter nozzle, you know, a new nozzle to
I think if like, it could, I just have a feeling that it's on purpose.
Yeah.
That like the way the motor is, it can't actually push air through that tiny thing. I think it would lose too much juice. It's amazing how much air it puts out, but I don't think it, for some reason, I just don't think it can do the tiny, tiny hose thing.
Well, I don't know.
Maybe it can.
But it looks like a Nintendo or a Nickelodeon, so it looks like it's from Double Dare. Like, it's surprise you win on Double Dare.
There you go.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. That was so fast. Oh, man.
Enjoy, baby. Things amazing.
Wow. Oh, my God. That was so fast. Oh, man. Yeah, it looks like a prize you win on Double Dare. It's frigging great, dude.
I have a other little follow-up too, is that I don't remember if it was on this show, probably was, and probably number of times that I've just, so like P3 color display, P3, everybody knows what that is, right?
Yeah.
It's a wider color. I want to say the correct word. It's not necessarily a model, because model just colors a color space, I guess, you know, this is more colors in it than the RGB or sRGB is. That's just such a big deal. I feel like we've talked about that number of times on this show. You can have redder reds and oranges and greener greens and stuff. It opens up the color space wider, and it's so cool, and it's just going to be the default going forward. And it's like CSS is caught up. Now you can use these colors, but you have to use the color function or LCH or OKLCH or lab or something, because unfortunately hex colors and like RGB and HSL and these ones that we've lived with for a very long time, they can't use it. They just can't. So bummer, right? But I think we'll just get more and more muscle memory for using the new color functions, because one of the things that they do is unlock the P3 color space. And even, and they're ready in case P3 someday gets even wider and there's some new color model that's even bigger than P3 is, those functions are ready to adapt to them, as I understand it.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
that's great. I think more and more and more and more and more of us are going to use P3 colors building websites going forward. In fact, we even surmised at one point that perhaps websites that don't do that will look a little drab potentially, especially when they're trying to look bright and exciting. You know, like if you were going to launch a new product and the brand color was intentionally exciting yellow and you didn't use P3, it would be weak sauce.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, so that's going on. And this all leads up to my thing is like, why haven't color pickers caught up to this yet? Like at all?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The OS level ones or third party add-ons and stuff, they just can't select colors in P3. If you are hovering over a P3 color, be it being used on the web or a common source of them is like you've taken a photograph with your iPhone or Android phone or whatever, it will be definitely producing JPEGs with colors in that range. Like that stuff happened first before the web technologies caught up to it. So if you use a color picker over that, you're probably a bunch of those colors are going to be in that P3 extended color space, but your color picker is just going to snipe it back down into sRGB space, which just sucks. Like what's with that? Get on it, color pickers.
Yeah.
Especially because there's like some money in it. You know, like if you have the best color picker that is the first one to support P3 colors, well, you got my $5 or whatever it is, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think it was Greg posted something in the Discord with the updates for Xscope. And I don't think he was talking about this specifically, but I saw that some of their features talked about P3 in different ways. But I was like, oh, I wonder if it can actually, like, does it have a color pickle built into Xscope? Xscope is this icon factory tool that does like lots of stuff. It's not just a color picker, but it happens to have a color picker in it as part of its loop tool. And wouldn't you know it, Dave, they do have Display P3 as one of the color formats that you can pick from. So kind of cool. And I tested it out, you know, and a way to test it out is just to like go to a website like OKLCH.com that's spitting out P3 colors, like make sure you have selected a color in that advanced space, which is easy to do on that website, and then hover over it with Xscope and hit their little keyboard command for copying the color. And sure enough, it copies it, and it even copies it in a CSS friendly format. It uses the color function.
Ooh.
To do it. And I tested it and it works great. So kind of cool. I don't love Xscope, I'm afraid. It's like a little heavy handed for me. There's like 10 tools built into it. And I don't like, just don't need any of them really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Although I could give it a minute. You know, there's like little interesting ones in there, like a Unicode character selector. It's like, I have my own little ways for doing that, but I could see using yours if I really wanted to. But there's a lot of stuff for like measuring what's happening on the screen and stuff that I'm like, I don't know, I'm not that deep into visual design that I need that stuff. But hey, gold star. First color picker I've ever seen that can do P3 colors. So
yeah, I wonder.
Well done.
Like yeah, it's interesting because it gets you like in P3, right? And so the color function. Remind me what that does again. That'll basically put it into like a. It'll
you have
basically
to tell
backwards
it what color
compat.
Model you want.
Yeah, you're saying like this is a P3 color with these numbers. But it'll like basically figure out what's the closest one if the monitor doesn't support P3. Is that right?
Yeah, or? But all of them can do that. So that's okay. Not unique to color. Color just, you know, and we're talking about color parentheses, like a literally a function in CSS. You've maybe never used it. A lot of people just don't even know that it exists, but I think it's been there for quite a while. But it's just a very generic function. So it forces you to say, okay, I'm declaring a color. Then you have to not optionally tell it what color space you're using, and then you provide the values after that. So it's like, why would you use that? Because all the color spaces have their own little function too. Mm-hmm. So like, why would you say color parentheses sRGB and then provide the RGB values when you could just say RGB and then put the values in there? So it's a little bit useless in that way. That's why, but the reason why you might have used is the very first browser to support P3 colors was Safari. And Safari didn't ship a P3 function. So if you wanted to use P3 colors on Safari, you had to use the color function and then say display P3. Interestingly, that's what Xscope copies into, or I guess that's why we started talking about this, but
yeah,
that's the way they do it. Because there is no just display P3 function in CSS. For some weird reason that I don't understand or like, you just can't do that. You have to use something else.
Interesting. Yeah. Yep. I mean, yeah, because I'd almost too like wanted an OKLCH, you know, like I'm just thinking of like,
yeah, that, yes, please.
RGB has worked for so long, right? Like in a, as like a, this is how many reds, this is how many blues, and this is how many greens are in the color, you know, it's in hex format, but like we have 0 to 255. OKLCH, I feel like, this is me, is more like, cool, I want this lightness, I want this amount of color, chroma, you know, or like, whatever, vibrancy, chroma, whatever that is.
It's like the HSL of the new color spaces.
I want this hue on the wheel, you know, and so I feel like that's way more idiomatic of like, I'm trying to express a color and you figure out what color is closest to that.
Exactly. Which that is not something that Lab has. That's another one of these. And Lab actually has some cool attributes. Like if you ask me, if you had to pick one that does the best job at gradient interpolation, I think Lab has OKLCH beat a little bit. But, you know, the looking at the three values of Lab, not intuitive.
Sure. Yeah, it is. It's just nonsense to me. Like it's, I'm trying to even think like what they mean. It's like lightness, albedo or something in blue or something like that. I don't know. It's weird. Yeah. I don't get it.
It may not even have been an intention of it. You know, they're like, this isn't for you. This is for, I don't know, for
people
colors or whatever.
Build pixels, like individual pixels.
Yeah. Which is fine. So that, you know, I think, I guess design engineers, we could use that term, will probably be more and more comfortable as time goes on in understanding the different color models and functions and spaces and all that, and picking the right one when needed. It's not going to be all the time, but if you have part of your muscle memory, you just happen to know, because, you know, gradients are part of people's muscle memory now, aren't they? You're like, they are to me. If I need to do like a left to right or top to bottom gradient, I don't even need to look it up. I know how to do that. I need to look it up sometimes when I'm like, oh yeah, like I need to rotate it. Like, where does the degrees go again or something? Or radial gradients are still like a little elusive to me. I'm like, okay, I need a circle in the top right corner. What is that again? And like, oh no, I actually don't need to enforce the circleness. I want it to be more ovular and make its way all the way to the bottom left corner. What's the syntax for that? I definitely have to look it up, you know? Mm-hmm. But there's just one little thing that you can now add to that syntax that says, okay, but what color space do you want to use also? Or model. I was using the wrong word. You can just say in a gradient now, well, use OKLCH or use OKLab or something. You can just say that. It's just a little extra keyword you can chuck in the gradient. And I don't think it's unreasonable to think that you know, a design engineer role or a CSS specialty type of person will just know that they can do that and use it when appropriate.
Yeah, I do think there's like that role is very necessary, just like CSS is moving so much and so rapidly and changing all the time. Like we need people who kind of follow it, keep up on it, and then also kind of understand these kind of niche concepts. You know, I don't want everyone to waste their brain space on understanding the different color spaces. But somebody needs to know it. And, you know, I'm happy if that somebody's me. So let me do that for you.
There you go. Yeah, rock and roll. I like, yeah. And, you know, certain things just become, I don't know, just part of the general industry knowledge of how it works. You know, nobody's like, should I use margin here? What, you know, like just name mm-hmm. something really obvious in CSS that like people just generally get that. I think some of this new CSS stuff, I don't know if color spaces will be one of those things, but you know, gap has already kind of gotten there. That was relatively new. And now people are just like, gap, got it. You know, certain things just become part of the general knowledge of what you should know and use. Fascinating, Sir Dave. What do we got here? I think you dropped a link in here from our buds at Cloud4.
Cloud4, yeah. So speaking of things, APIs that are like oppressively confusing. this was a really good post from Scott Vandehey at Cloud4 about the file API and
which one, Dave?
Yeah, so that's the trick. Is there's about 12, I feel like.
Oh, well, I'll read it. He says there's the file API, the file API again, the file system access API, the file system and file writer API, the file reader API, the file list API, the file system API, and the file API. And then a file reader API again, and the file entry sync API or something. That's just like, holy buckets.
Yeah.
That's a lot of them. And why would you use one of these at all? Like, what's the simplest use case? Is it like, pick a file from my computer? No, that's just an input of type file, right?
Well, that would be like one. Like, but like, let's say you're making a markdown editor in HTML and you want to write to disk instead of write to the cloud. Or you're making your own spreadsheet application. You want to write a CSV to disk every time somebody hits save instead of writing to a database in the cloud. So that's where the file API or file. That's where the file API tries to exist. And then there's like file reader API where like if you're, you know, trying to. If you use input type file and you don't want to like send that to another server, like you're not sending that blob to another server, you want to actually interact with the contents of that file. Like you want to parse a Word doc or a PDF or something. That's the file reader API. So there's different kinds of things you're trying to do with files. And these APIs try to solve them. And then a lot of them, like the ones where there's like three named all the same, like sometimes there's been different generations of these file APIs where they have tried to solve the problem, but it didn't get adopted in another browser, or it's sort of like broken or something like that. So there's a lot, and then like there's like file list APIs and stuff like that. That's like getting like a directory of files and stuff like that. So
it seems kind of important to the, like, for example, I think everybody knows there's various versions of VS Code in the browser, right? That could not exist if these APIs didn't exist. You know, like it wouldn't be a functional piece of
VS Code is probably the perfect example. You know, and there may be some like trickery that can happen through Electron or whatever, but that where it uses Electron's API, like Node API or something like that. But yeah, this stuff wouldn't exist like just like that.
No.
Yeah.
Right. And if they really nail this, there'll be more websites that use it. Unfortunately, it's so complicated. It probably has already pushed away untold people that could have benefited from it potentially, but oh well, I'm sure it'll settle out eventually, maybe.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I thought this was cool just because it was like a nerdy deep dive on stuff on all the different same named things. And so I think like it's worth reading to kind of know that this is a possibility for you and your website.
I will think of it immediately next time I need to use one of these APIs. I'm like, oh, I better go read the lay of the land post.
Yeah. And so I think like the file system API is sort of the one right now. But then there's also, And a lot of them you have to kind of do through an origin trial, I think, is somehow some of those features come through that. So you're not like a bad actor. They could revoke your API key if you were. Yeah, your mileage is going to vary, you know, here. But I think it's, you know, there's also a chance to like it adds fingerprinting and stuff like that. So it'll never make it past security, which is fair enough too, you know, like.
Yeah, because these things can be kind of scary too. You're like, oh, I'm sorry. I can go to a website and it can read files off my computer. That sounds horrible, you know.
Yeah,
but it's like it's all very permissions oriented and scoped and stuff. But it would pay to understand all that. I don't think I've heard any horror stories about it or anything. It feels like it's pretty straightforward if granting access.
I think people that are doing it are people who need to. Does that make sense? It's people who are like writing for a reason, you know, reading your file system for a reason, sort of like a VS Code kind of situation, you know. So
yeah.
So anyway, I would definitely check it out. So yeah,
good article. That's good blogging, team. Good job. Our blog's still a thing. Get out of here.
Our blog's still a thing. Yeah, just find something complicated and pull the thread, man. Pull the thread.
Yeah. Nick Nolte writes, and we'll just finish up with this one, I think, probably, because it's a fun question, I think. It's in 2024, right now, are light boxes still a thing? There's probably people listening that are like, what is a light box? I feel like it was like an early web term or something. It mostly means modal, I think. Is that what you think?
Yeah, I mean, it mostly would be a modal.
What a weird word. How did that come to be?
Yeah, it was sort of like in 2009, every image on your website needed to be in a light box of some kind, right? Yeah. And you'd click an image, for example, but it could be an iframe. It could be all kinds of things showing up in this light box. But you click an image, and then you click left and right arrows and go to the next image. It was kind of a fast way to speed through images. It
could do that. That would be an additional feature.
Right.
But basically, if you clicked it, it just opened a bigger version of itself on the thing. And then Dave's saying, well, it could animate to do that. It could have a cool black background or something, maybe. It could be paginated or whatever. So you could go to the next thing too.
The best one was the panic one that like zoomed in and had the little black.
Yeah, you wanted the zoom
X. Oh God, that was so cool. Anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you need to be able to close it and all that. And I'm sure at the time accessibility was, you know, in much worse, despite what Jacob Nielsen might tell you, it was in much worse shape. than it was then. So who knows what it was harming in that sense.
Right.
But yeah, so are they still a thing now? And I think that's a fascinating question because I think there probably was a period after that where people are like, what if images didn't do that? And then we lived through that for a long time too. Not that they're back necessarily, but I think of my own use of them and I'm like, yeah, they're, you know, I think it's settled down to a reasonable level. Like if you're shopping on Amazon, yeah, you can still, it's still there to some degree, or there's some kind of way of viewing images bigger, and that's reasonable because it's shopping. You know, I feel like the shopping experience still leans heavily on them, and that's fine to me. My personal use otherwise too is just that I just have like Jetpack installed on my WordPress blog, you know, and I like their little gallery feature sometimes, and I just do nothing at all but drag some images onto my blog post, and that just kind of naturally has that experience, and I just don't mind it. I haven't cared enough to be like, to force it to not do that. I'm like, yeah, it's fine. Especially because my blog layout is such that it's like center constrained, so it's probably not even 1,000 pixels wide or so. And it's like, that means that when I put an image in there, unless I really specifically have it be this kind of breakout of grid experience, that's as big as it can be. And I figured, hey, what the hell? If somebody's got a bigger monitor, let them click it and see it even bigger. The irony being that that's still there on mobile. And I always think that's hilarious to me when there's a light box on modal that sometimes when you open the light box, the design is such that the image that you clicked on is actually smaller when
it's in the light box. More padding, right?
Yeah.
It's like
well, bravo. That didn't work.
Yeah. I wish there was more because sometimes that, you know, I've been you know, eyesight's going bad, you know, I'm in bifocal territory, so I'm zooming in, you know, like, yeah. Or like tapping in to see things and stuff like that. Sometimes I wish I could like get that, you know, zoomed in, but I would say, you know, I think a few things are against light boxes. We don't just put 14 megabyte images on the on the homepage anymore, you know, like,
right.
So like, and there used to be, you just put it on there small, like in a grid, you know, a gallery grid. And then you'd like click that image and that would be the image that would get huge, you know?
That's a good point because
we don't do that anymore.
Otherwise so. The animation isn't going to work really. Cause as it got bigger, then it, you know, it would be expanding and exhibiting that, that nature of, you know, when you force a JPEG to be wider than its original, so it's all blurry and crappy. So if you take a thumbnail and you animate it bigger, it's going to look like crap, but not if it's a 14 megabyte JPEG.
Nope. It works every time when it's a 14 megabyte JPEG.
Yeah.
So we don't do that anymore. Right.
Right.
And then I would also say like, tablets and phones, man, the fact that we can't, you know, most, I would say if you're have the dexterity, you can zoom in, you know, you can pinch zoom in to any photo in the world now.
Right.
Like that sort of has killed the effect of having to like manually kind of offer that to people. So it's sort of like almost like what am I trying to say? Like the idioms of the operating system got good enough, you know, to do that. And in fact, I'm looking at like posts on my site. I can like double tap on my trackpad, like two finger double tap, and it'll full scale that image to that width. It works the same with videos. You can double tap, two tap a video and it'll go like pseudo full screen, you know? So, it'll like just pinch zoom in to that width. And so I think pinch zoom and gestures have changed the game for light boxes as well. So
that's a good point. Yeah. I would definitely err on not using them. You should use them when you really know you need them. Yeah.
I think galleries, you know, could use them. I think, you know, like if I was making Flickr today, I'd still probably have it, you know? But image carousels, just putting the image big and having left and right arrows is also a very popular, probably better situation, even though carousels are terrible.
Yeah, I guess it's only really relevant when you know that you're displaying the image smaller than an ideal experience might be for that image.
Yeah. I said panic earlier, but like the panic had it on their Coda website, I think then they put it on all their websites. But like that was cool because you're looking at a screenshot of an app, right? A desktop application, and like you'd zoom in and then you'd see the whole thing like full desktop size almost. And like, it really gave you a sense of what was going on. So I feel like that was, very helpful. Like you just saw like a little small version of it and then you get a big version. I think maybe the trend too is just make that image as big as possible in the layout. And so like, you know, Apple does that now, you know, it's just, oh, you want to see the iPhone? Cool. Here it is, really big. Like that's just, we're not going to make you like pinch zoom in to see the iPhone. So maybe we've just gotten better at web design. So
yeah, maybe that's it. That's a very positive way thought, I think. And I think it's true that we, just as a whole, things tend to get better.
Mm-hmm.
The way that the choices that we make. I mean, we're shipping too much JavaScript and stuff, but like I would say the experience on your average website is just better now.
Yeah, I think it's easier to make new but nicer experiences. And I think just the collective hive mind of what's good is up there too, you know?
Yeah. Thanks, developer evangelists.
Yeah, we quit putting sounds on web pages. Good for us. We could maybe use more sounds, but
right.
Like,
and we stopped using, you know, 10 pixel Verdana locked into that size. And
yeah, look
and
at us
using tables for layout and yeah, whatever. We've done lots of smart stuff.
We're doing good.
Look at us,
despite what Jacob Nielsen says. So hey. on that note, we should wrap it up. Thank you, dear listener, for making good websites. We really appreciate that. And we appreciate you listening to the show. Tell a million friends so Chris is wrong about the number of stats we get. And then just a million cool mil would be cool downloads. And then, how you can really make an impact is head over to the Discord. Join the Discord, patreon.com/shopdocshow, because we'd love to have you. And Chris, you got anything else you'd like to say?
Shopdocshow.com.